So we'll move on to our second group of speakers, thank you, who are starting with the provocation that the humanities must engage beyond the academy. And I'd like to welcome Josh Lambier, Emma Lang, Jade McDougall and Matthew Gaster. Josh, I'll just get you to move one over, or everybody move one down, please, so that I can all harass you about timing. Thank you very much. Who would like to be first? Would you like the mic or the mic? Yeah? Okay.
So I'm coming to this with two hats. One is as an emissary of the Student Caucus. The other one is as the Director of the Public Humanities, which is an entirely graduate-run program at the University of Western Ontario that we've done. And actually, this is our fourth anniversary this May. We started in 2011. But I'm going to speak to the Public Humanities more specifically at a session tomorrow morning with Professor Gibbs and Professor Zwicker. So I'm going to focus specifically on one question, which is the idea of public scholarship. So let me begin with some provocative questions here. What roles do community engagement and public scholarship have to play in the humanities as we forge ahead with plans to reinvent the graduate experience? During a time of change and crisis in higher education, what does it mean for our universities to reimagine their civic commitment and to explore new spaces of engagement at the student, faculty, and institutional levels? How do we cultivate a graduate experience that fosters global thinking? And I'm thinking here of universities now that are putting internationalization in their strategic plans. And of course, Western strategic plan, this is the fundamental gravity of our plan. So what does it mean to cultivate that global thinking, which is so important, while also promoting programs and partnerships that feature community-based learning and research at the local level that are mutually beneficial to our campuses and their publics? And I'm purposely putting that in the plural because we do have multiple and sometimes overlapping publics, and our cities that we're housed, I think, are underutilized by the universities in Canada right now. How, in short, will we advance the civic turn currently taking hold in higher education across Canada, the U.S., and beyond? I take the term civic turn from a number of scholars, but specifically David Scobie, a former dean of the New School of Public Engagement, who has recently argued that higher education is going through a sea change in its intellectual, institutional, technological, and economic organization. Changes that call for reevaluation in the way professors are trained, certified, hired, and arrayed in faculties. Many of these factors are indeed beyond the control of our faculty and university administrators in the arts and humanities, either because they are the result of structural conditions and global forces or the decisions of funders and policymakers, and I can see some of those people are actually in this room too. Nevertheless, the conditions of possibility for the older model of humanities graduate education has shifted under our feet, whether we like it or not. In the wake of structural seismic changes, our familiar paradigm is undergoing a moment of crisis, which has fueled the defensive rhetoric of the crisis of the humanities that we read seemingly weekly in op-eds and academic periodicals. And yet, at this moment of crisis, and this is a familiar term to find opportunity in crisis, there is a moment of opportunity, what Scobie calls a Copernican moment. And he's following, of course, Kuhn's idea of structural transformations, revolutionary structural transformations. A moment to emerge from a defensive posture and aggressive specialization to embrace a more public humanities with a reinvigorated commitment to the public good. Our commitment to the public good must take place at the very level of our training and promotion and tenure policy, which means our reinvestment to the public begins with a review of what counts as research for graduate students and early career faculty. What we need is an intentional interinstitutional commitment to a new concept of publicly engaged scholarship. And if there's one term that I'd like you to take away from what I have to say, it's publicly engaged scholarship, which would help to realize the white paper's aspiration to produce new research deliverables, including the outcomes of the workshop PhD and the PhD in applied humanities. If humanities research is the basic atomic unit of the PhD, as it should be, we need a moment of fission that will unleash the energy of graduate research and create a multiplicity of forms beyond the basic dissertation as a future monograph or research article in a continuum. What we need is a continuum of artifacts that will be afforded equal and full standing in the process of adjudicating the PhD's project's success at the eventual next step of tenure and promotion. Why bring in tenure and promotion policy in an already difficult question on graduate education? As we know, there's a narrative teleology that forecasts back the ideals of the profession into the training of a new generation of scholars, which means that what counts as rigorous scholarship for a tenure-track faculty will have a bearing on what is considered rigorous for a PhD. Just what counts as rigorous for engaged academic work should be established and clearly and transparently determined at the outset of the process. One of the most widespread or widely adopted definitions of public scholarship comes from the work of Imagining America, Artists and Scholars in Public Life, which is a national consortium of over 90 American universities and colleges dedicated to the expanding role of public research in the arts and humanities. And let me point out right now that we do not have something like this in Canada, and nothing really close. And it's maybe about time that we did start to organize something that would look like this in a national level. Publicly engaged academic work, according to Imagining America, is, quote, scholarly or creative activity integral to a faculty member's academic area. It encompasses different forms of making knowledge about, for, and with diverse publics and communities. Through a coherent and purposeful sequence of activities, it contributes to the public good and yields artifacts of public and intellectual value. Of course, we as Canadian humanists need to find a definition or constellation of concepts that best fits the mission, value, and strategic goals of the humanities in Canada. So at the outset of our proceedings for the next couple of days, I would suggest Canadian humanities scholars could open new avenues for graduate education and training by cultivating a renewed ethos of citizenship and service in the humanities disciplines. But we need to do so in a way that embeds this ethos in research practices and processes of adjudication, which means that we have a lot of work to do to convince faculty members who still believe, as Stanley Fish said in his influential New York Times blog, that the public humanities amounts to bake sales and Renaissance festivals. Until there's a culture shift motivated by commitment to publicly engaged scholarship, we will continue to miss out on engagement opportunities that American universities and colleges have been activating in a robust and meaningful way, including public humanities grants from the Mellon Foundation and the National Endowment of the Humanities. It's time for the humanities in Canada to engage our public and cultivate our constituencies within our communities. Thank you.
So we think that public engagement is one of the key things that should be discussed at this conference, so I'm also going to be addressing that. But I'm going to do a slightly different, Josh and I come from very different backgrounds and have very different approaches to our scholarship, so I'm going to talk in a slightly different milieu. So I, as background, I'm an American, I'm an international student. I was also trained as a museum curator and worked for 5 years as a historic museum curator before returning to the academy to get my PhD in history. I also come from a college town in Massachusetts, and that and all of these factors play into how I view public engagement. And I would ask that you think about, when you think about engaging beyond the university, think about your own experiences, not just your experiences in the communities you live today, but also your experiences growing up and what your views of the academy were when you were a child. As the child of academics, I can tell you that it's often easy to lose track of those relationships and views the older you get, and it's true for me too. I constantly have to remind myself that I am a townie and will always be a townie. No matter where I am a townie. Which should give you a clue as to what town in Massachusetts I'm from. So we as institutions, our institutions have either explicit or implicit mandates to serve the public. And that means looking at practical ways that we can go out into our communities. Part of the goal of the group of graduate students was to present you with ideas of how we can take the ideas that we came up with yesterday and bring them back. When we think about engaging the public, when we think about public scholarship, we have to think practically. And we have to think both very small scale, but also very large scale. Often we get caught up in saying we're engaging the community by having public talks or saying that they can come to this organization and see this or that they can come on campus. And in a lot of our communities, going on campus is a humongous step and it's a huge risk for members of the community to take. So we need to think about ways that we can bring our scholarship out into the community. Naturally, as a museum professional, I think that everything should be in exhibit form or tour form, but it can take whatever form you mean. Maybe it means working with local authors. Maybe it means bringing an analysis. Okay, you're a local poet. Let's bring a scholar of poetry and do a reading. They can be the most obvious things, and often they're sitting directly in front of our noses. I'm at Memorial University, and we do pretty well when it comes to engaging the public, but that's also because the public insists on engaging with us. If something happens on campus, it makes the CBC, and there are endless comments, and we get total blowback. My neighbors will come and say, what about that thing on campus? How are you fixing that? Where are our tax dollars going? But that's actually really important. And even at institutions that are in cities, we need to remember that the community matters, and how they view us matters. It matters because we are the community. We live in the community, and we can't disassociate and pretend that when we walk on campus, we're going into a different world. We may be many ways, but we're still part of that broader community. It's also important in thinking about some of the other goals we have as scholars in the humanities and as members of academic communities. We want to make sure, we constantly talk about the need to engage underrepresented populations. We want to see more students of color on our campuses. We want to have faculties that aren't just white folks. We want to see indigenous students feeling welcome on our campuses, and we also want to have international students. In the history department at MUN, we are either Canadian or we are American, and that's not representative of either Newfoundland or the country or the world. But we need to do that, and through public engagement we can, by reaching out to those communities and demonstrating that the university isn't scary and that these graduate programs are representative and that these graduate programs have value and that we're relating it back to the community is crucial. Some of this might seem obvious, and I think we often talk about it, but I ask that you think to yourself about the community that you live in and think about your place also in the broader national community and how we can work on that. So please, my last request is, we're starting conversations today, and the first way to involve public engagement is to start conversations. Please, any of the graduate students who are in this room are happy to talk to you about any of our issues, whether we discuss them or not. But we also ask you to take your questions that you're asking us and bring them back to your home campuses. Those graduate students and those undergraduates need to be involved in this conversation too.
Hello. I'd just like to take a quick moment to acknowledge that we're standing on the traditional territory of Indigenous peoples such as Mohawk and Anishinaabe. So I'm going to talk about student diversity and how we need to sort of make this a priority within the academic system. And I'll be approaching that through my own lens of Indigenous students because I can't speak to other students' experiences. And I think if we try to generalize diversity, that's counterproductive, right? So I find that humanities departments are really trying to include Indigenous texts, Indigenous criticism in the study and in the curriculum, but what about Indigenous students themselves? And this is a very quickly growing demographic, especially out west where I'm from. Indigenous population is booming, and we're going to see a lot of that coming through to representation on campus. And yet we find that I think still in grad studies and in career academia, the scholarly conventions and expectations are very much based in a Eurocentric model. So some examples that I'd like to just give really quick are, for example, expectations around seminar participation, modes of conversation and what's considered to be respectful engagement in discourse can be very, very different in certain Native societies than from Euro-Canadian society. And you find often that students may, for example, hang back in discussions where Euro-Canadians tend to dominate just based on that cultural idea of discourse. And not even to mention the fact that, of course, there's also going to be a strong colonized dynamic in the classroom as there is everywhere in Canada. So that's one example. Another is the expectation that academics will be needing to, say, move institutions frequently for different degrees, for example. I think this carries a lot of assumptions about mobility, about community, family, gender roles, and just the idea that perhaps someone's scholarship is actually land-based if you're an Indigenous student. So these expectations about responsibility to your family and to your home community can be very, very significant, and I think we're not taking that into account when we say, you know, maybe you want to consider moving to a different province to get your next degree. We need to start thinking about these things. The third thing I'd just like to mention really quick are just the types of projects and the types of criticism that are considered acceptable within sort of a scholarly realm, which sort of erases the kinds of individual subjectivity and storytelling that are quite essential to Indigenous ways of knowing, and that I think we need to start acknowledging to a greater degree and start accepting to a greater degree. And I would just ask the people who are here to consider how the university might feel as an unfamiliar institution. So many of these students are first-generation students. We need to remember this. And we also need to keep in mind that their home communities, families, and personal life histories often have a very fraught and problematic relationship with authority and institutions. I think we can't forget that the university is a colonial institution. So I would just ask everyone to take a hard look at the assumptions and the privilege that are inherent in certain scholarly expectations, to really interrogate why we're so wedded to these expectations and whether we ought to be. And I would encourage departments to work with community members to arrive at an understanding that will maintain academic integrity and rigor, because of course that's important, but we also need to respect regional particularities. We know that many institutions, University of Saskatchewan included, offer transitional courses to help Indigenous students adjust to university life, urban life even, and culture, but do we even try to meet these students halfway by familiarizing professors and grad student teachers, administrators, with these students' needs, right, trying to familiarize them and trying to decolonize higher education from both ends? So we can't just pay lip service, I suppose, to Indigenous scholarship and think that we've done our job as humanities departments without also addressing the needs of the Indigenous students themselves. And I think that as humanities scholars, we can and really should be leading the way here. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Matthew, and I feel that it's somewhat important to finish our panel by recognizing, as the white paper does, that 85-90% of us aren't going to stay in academia when we're done the PhD. And I think that the white paper does a good job of acknowledging this, but doesn't actually do anything to investigate more about it. And I think part of the problem is that nobody, or very few people in this room and in our home institutions, knows really what awaits the 85 to 90% of us when we leave academia. You always end up getting those anecdotal stories of, well, I know this person and I know that person, but there's no real systematic study or knowledge of what awaits us. And a lot of the topics that we have been talking about, mental health, mentorship, finishing times, I think can all be related to the fact that so many of us, as we near the end of our degrees, are going, well, what's next? Because there's not a lot of academic jobs. And so I think it's really important to re-envision the dynamics of the degree itself, issues like transparency and accountability with funding, and re-envisioning what counts as research. But I think it's also important to, again, quote the white paper, not to abandon 85 to 90% of doctoral scholars as sacrifices to the institutionalized humanities. And I think that's really important to look at. So one of the things that I've got a few kind of suggestions for ways that the university can address this. I think, first of all, a study should be done. I think that we should be asking businesses, nonprofits, what they're looking for in employees and what a PhD in the humanities can actually offer them. And I'm not saying that we should revise the PhD to teach these skills. I think the PhD and students who engage in the PhD already have many of these skills that are valuable. And I think that it's a matter of finding out exactly what they need and what they're looking for. And I think that engaging with universities should be engaging with local businesses, and a more national effort should be made to discover these things. Also, I think that we should, the university, as Nadia was mentioning, mentorship. No one in the institution is able to mentor in all these faculties. And most faculty members grew up through academia and have always and only ever been academics. And that's not true of everyone, but a large number of them are, and they're most prepared to mentor you in academia and in your dissertation, in getting academic jobs. And they're not always aware of the professional world outside of academia. And I think bringing in outside experts, we had a wonderful workshop yesterday by Ann Crook that really dealt with some of these issues. And the hunger for it was evident in the room. There was a lot of basic questions and advanced questions about how to engage with the outside of academia and find work, because ultimately we need to have sustenance to live when we're done this, because we also talked about how we barely have sustenance to live in it. So to come out and not have any options is rough. I also think that while this issue and finding work outside of academia is ultimately up to the individual, I mean, we don't expect to be handed a job when we finish, I do think that both the university and the government has a stake in this process. The federal government pours a lot of money through the provinces into our education, depending on the different funding structures, but it's in the tens of thousands of dollars to educate a PhD. And if 85 to 90% of us end up working somewhere that isn't utilizing these skills, that's problematic. And so I think universities, as they do for undergrads, should be invested in networking and connecting their PhD students to jobs and to be working with local business and abroad to make these kind of connections. I've heard many stories of businesses, once they've hired kind of one PhD, that they look for more because they do such good work. But I'm not entirely sure that the world at large is aware of the value that a PhD in the humanities can offer them. And so I think that there should be an institutional and a national effort to what I've kind of somewhat provocatively called market the PhD in the humanities. So I think that's important. And just a few kind of provocative points to end my little time here. I think this is not to say that the humanities should capitulate to neoliberal capitalist ideals that run the market. Obviously, humanities' job is to push against these ideas, and we shouldn't just become another MBA pushing people into jobs. That's not what I'm talking about here. But I think it is important, again, not to abandon 85 to 90% of us to figure things out on our own, because it leads to things like mental health issues and not completing and all sorts of anxiety. Perhaps another kind of provocative thing is maybe the PhD in the humanities doesn't actually offer enough, doesn't offer anything that can be marketed in the neoliberal capital world. And that's something that we may have to come to grips with and figure out ways around it. And then my final one is a bit of an accusation, I suppose, against the university. And I don't think anybody's necessarily doing this intentionally, but perhaps one of the reasons why the university hasn't invested in finding non-academic jobs and off-ramps for PhD students is that they depend on a desperate, willing to work for anything workforce for their sessional labor. Thank you.
Thank you so much to all our panelists. I'm going to be really, really annoying and jump in with a question first because I have a microphone. But also because I think this is to Emma and Josh, and then maybe Matthew as well. We spoke a lot yesterday about what research means and this connection between the ideas of public humanities and bringing the humanities outside the university. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what you said yesterday in terms of the value, the relative value of the dissertation relative to other forms of creative output and connections, because I know that was important to both of you.
Yeah, research, when you look at the white paper, when you look at most documents, the MLA report is really great on this as well, to an MLA representative in the room. Really wonderful. Research has to be, I call it the atomic unit, but what we need to do is have this moment of fission, which is to blow it up, and blow it up in a great sense, which is to say unleash the energy of what goes into the skills that derive a dissertation. We have so many graduate students right now who curate shows, who put together museum exhibitions. I have guys on my team and girls on my team who have created engagement opportunities between the City of London and the University of Western Ontario that bring on over 200 community partners. And no one's doing this at the faculty level. So it's graduate students who are mobilizing this activity. We started London's first literary festival with Museum London. None of this activity will ever see anything to do with the adjudicating of whether they're a successful PhD student, and that is garbage, in my opinion. Absolute garbage. If you're doing stuff that's interesting and there's a continuum of scholarship, what you can do is, yes, there's going to be things that have more value. A monograph and a research article, of course, they're a gold standard, but we need to maybe unhitch the gold standard and start to go a little bit more towards things that float. And that continuum is a great way of thinking about it. It is imagining America's model. Doesn't mean that it has to be our model, but it's a good place to start about thinking about how research can look different. And to go to Matthew's point, if research has the opportunity to have multiple forms, then what you can do is design your PhD in a way that you can take some of that out with you. So if the dissertation is on something like Chaucer, and it's hard sometimes not to in any way impinge the Chaucer experts in the room, it could be any author in a period that feels historically based, you can take something with you. And we've all seen projects that bridge vast distances of time and can leave with you very well and in a robust way.
So my background is as a museum curator, and my hope is to stay a curator and once I've gotten my PhD. And so it's very important that I have practical application as part of my work. Unfortunately, that practical application cannot be included as part of my funding. I'm lucky that I'm in a department that somehow figures out ways to sort of scoop me little bits of extra money to help cover some of those costs. But if you're not in an institution that, or in a department that is open to the idea of someone entering a PhD program and hoping to do public engagement both while they're doing their degree, but also after, it's often very isolating. And I actually chose the university that I'm at partly because of that being a large part of their mandate, but also the ideology of my department. So we need to think about research as and skill development as part of what we get out, but also something that we need funding for. It takes a lot of time. I developed an exhibit this year, and it took a lot of time. It was as much as a regular TA-ship at Memorial, which is 56 hours, so limited anyway. But that wasn't something that I could do as a TA or an RA, because there simply isn't a funding structure. Yet it's crucial both for my dissertation project, but it's also crucial for what I'm hoping to do when I graduate. So we need to think about this. But this also goes to what Jade was saying, as thinking of different ways of learning and how we do scholarship. One of the ways that we can be more inclusive in our diverse students is thinking about, okay, so you need to produce a dissertation, but what does that research mean? And how does that work within your cultural ideology or the work you want to do? And both of those are equally important. And we need to think beyond that. And we also need to think about that as part of the funding structure, so that we're getting paid for the work that we're doing. We're getting paid for doing exhibits. We're getting paid for reaching out to the community. And that's being given value. So that time isn't on top of everything else, which, as we've talked about, the biggest concern for us is funding and mental health. And I hope I'm not speaking out of turn by saying that, but those are closely linked. And when we want to do these more alternative projects, we often wind up working harder, taking more hours, and using our own funds to do these projects that benefit beyond. So it's really important in thinking about that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, understanding that there are many people in this room that engage in various and alternative forms of scholarship. And I think that it's a shame that anybody who does this labor isn't compensated for it and isn't given credit for doing that work. So I don't think it's just limited to PhD students. But yes, I agree that the humanities needs to find ways of recognizing and rewarding alternative work, because as a PhD student, as a faculty member, we have a lot of work on our plate already, and so it actively discourages additional and public scholarship by not encouraging it. And related to my point, of course, the dissertation as a long monograph isn't particularly relevant to most non-academic careers, whereas many other forms of public engagement are.
I just want to also add one more thing, is that oftentimes it's very hard to figure out how to put these types of work into funding applications, and especially for international students who have a very, very limited pool. There are only, I think, 4 or 5 Canadian options for us to apply for, and as an American, there are very few American options that I can apply for that aren't just pure loans. So we need to be able to make sure that we're getting fund, that we can figure out a way in our field, in our broad field, that these, that we can get credit for this, not just financial credit and department credit, but also credit when we apply for scholarships, when we apply for different funding options. Because that's often, I've had to translate my museum CV into a academic CV, and it's really tricky to do, and it's really tricky to explain that I have research experience and value from that if you're not used to what museum professionals do.
So I think we have a couple of questions down here. Sorry, I think Stephen was first.
Hi, Steve Jackson from Memorial University, and Emma speaks well for us in a lot of ways with regards to community engagement. The other, I think, interesting part, and I want to bring it back more to Jade and that, because we had this discussion yesterday about, if you'll excuse slightly, the difference between the, you know, we're talking a vast group of disciplines here, really. When we say, oh, the arts and humanities, there's no one way to fix this, you know. What Jade has offered to us is one very big aspect of what we do study, and that is how cultures work together, how different learning styles, different cultures of learning. And this woman up here also raised the problem of those people who are very interested in languages and how communication works and ancient languages and et cetera. And these are very difficult things to bring out to the public sphere and say, by the way, Exxon, would you like to give some money so that we can show off how indigenous people are really feeling that they're not belonging right now, and how can we fix that? Because it is these people who, in fact, that we are critiquing. One of the problems I think we have is that yesterday was a tiny bit of an apology, I think, to the many grad students sitting there and saying, well, you know what, there ain't anything here for you anymore. Sorry about that. Here's how to go get a job somewhere else. I think the point is that humanities people and graduate students feel they are creating the forums, that these are the jobs that are there, and this is where accountability comes in. How is the university changing the way that they offer venue for these public studies? When our Newfoundland government wants to know about how people are getting along in the community of Newfoundland, they don't go to the university. I don't know why, but they went to Goss Gilroy, which was a corporate research structure. We feel that we are doing this research. We feel that we are trying to critique what we see around us. And I don't think we necessarily see what company is going to buy this. What company is going to support this with funding and grants and et cetera. Jade, I don't know where you may feel that you're, I don't know what you're studying, but I'm studying internationalization, and I don't, and everybody says, you know, if you look inside your community, you're going to find people who can tell you how to change your curricula, etc., to deal with styles of learning, and yet likely we may be going elsewhere to find this expertise, rather than in our own groups and in our own think tanks that Sarah has suggested. Jade, I don't know. Where do you see yourself going, perhaps?
Well, for myself, I'm currently in English studying indigenous self-produced underground music texts. So it's sort of, it's not literary, let's just say that. But I think that when people start to place or start to acknowledge the value of these cultural productions that are not considered literary, that are not considered high culture, I think that my job isn't to lend legitimacy to these things, because I think they are legitimate, but it's to give them a voice
And not even to give a voice, but to simply say, here they are. I mean, look at them. They're fabulous, right? And as far as I'm concerned, it's not just in the subject matter that we're covering. It's how we're approaching our scholarship and just the very fabric of scholarship itself. There's this colonial structure to it that we need to really try to dismantle.
And where are you going to sell that?
I'm so sorry, but we might have to take this offline. Jacob, you had a question?
Yes, I'm Jacob Sagerins, PhD candidate here at McGill in Musicology. It's actually more of a comment than a question. I think this discussion of having research being more publicly engaged and bringing in a broader public is great. And while research is a large part of what we do in academia, there's other things as well. There's teaching, there's service work. So I think it's important to consider how we can engage people outside academia in our teaching and service work as well, because that will strengthen connections as well between the university and outside university.
There and then here. Oh. I just wanted to reiterate that we're prioritizing the graduate students in this session, but of course everyone is going to have plenty of time throughout the next 2 days to keep talking on these subjects.
Hi, Christina Foisy from York University in Humanities. I just have a question around engagement. That word has been used a lot, and I love using that word. But I sometimes wonder, in the context of decolonization and thinking through modes of knowledge production and how to think differently and appreciate cultural production and voices that have been marginalized from the colonial university institution, what does engagement mean? How do we evaluate whether we are engaging with populations in meaningful ways and not tokenizing, not speaking for, and so I'm curious about, like, I think you guys obviously have a lot to say about that, but are we being critical of that word and how so? Thank
you. Yeah, I think the most essential thing is to start with the community, right? And like every engagement, especially when you're talking about indigenous communities, every engagement needs to benefit the community. It cannot only benefit the academy, right? And we need to start from that perspective. And I have done community like service learning courses in my time at the U of S as one of the areas I think that we're trying to develop and that we're trying to engage with quite responsibly. But it's essential that whatever service learning you're doing, it's about the service first and foremost, because you cannot take advantage of these communities. It needs to originate from their needs and what. So I think it's just a matter of working very, very closely with the organization in question and really determining what their needs are and how we can help them first.
I think that I want to expand what Jade said also, because I live in a province that is incredibly rural, that it also involves doing exactly the same thing with rural and working class communities. And I think we often, those groups, though not to the same extent as indigenous communities, often also get sidelined. And we go in and we say, oh, well, I'm going to do research on rural fishers or rural whatevers. And that's really problematic as well. So, yeah, so just expanding that beyond trying to incorporate more groups.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the panelists again. I'm Toby Mudi from Queen's University, and I'm just picking on the points that were made by Josh and Emma and on public engagement again. And I think it's one of the things we mentioned yesterday, which I maybe just want you to touch a bit on, and that is on completion times, because there's a strong link between actually engaging the community and, as we've talked about, and actually the funding discussion that we've had earlier, because many times you're pegged in by the time you have to complete your PhD, and actually this could take a stretch on what you do. So maybe just some thoughts on that.
Where do I begin? I see in the back of the room my chair of my department is overhearing this, so I have to be careful. And yet, at the same time, I have to admit that I am in my extra innings of my PhD, and maybe even by the time I'm done will look like double time. But look, I feel like I've done double work, actually, if I could say this on behalf of people who do publicly engaged scholarship. Right in the middle of doing a marathon, which is a PhD, I went mountain climbing to try and build a public humanities project where when I started doing this activity, I went downtown into the City of London with my Jerry Maguire document, my vision statement, and I met with all the Museum London, I met with the Arts Council, the Heritage Councils, and I met with the Grand Theater, and I met with all these people. They loved it. They thought it was absolutely fantastic. I came back to the university and did a similar tour of faculty members, about 75 to 80 in the summer of 2011. I got kicked out of offices, I got lukewarm responses, I got hot responses of this is exactly what we need, but it was dicey. And there was moments where my supervision, some supervisors just thought, well, we don't know what Lambier is up to. What is this guy doing? And it was just a passion and a commitment to the fact that I felt like a part of me going into grad school had been amputated because I couldn't do publicly engaged scholarship, which is to go back to your question, which is in order for publicly engaged scholarship to be meaningful and to be part of a progression model, it has to be part of it. And if it's going to be part of it, our faculty have to turn around and start to recognize why this is important. Maybe it doesn't look like the way that you did your research model, but supervisors have to start taking and sitting down and listening, and rather than just saying, I don't have anything to say about this, I don't speak like a politician, I don't know what this looks like, they have to sit down and say, tell me what it is that you're doing and why this should go public. Until that takes place, to do publicly engaged scholarship is going to take you 7, 8, however many years. If it's incorporated, if it's robust, if we sit down and we talk about policy and what it looks like, how it's adjudicated, how supervisors can engage, how they can help, even if they don't know it, it's unfamiliar to them, without that, it's going to look really difficult. Completion times, to me, it's an important one, it's an inevitable one, but to me it's a bit of an epiphenomenon of other more structural issues. You address the real issues, and then you're going to watch completion times come down. If you go to completion times and say, that's the one we're going to fix, it's going to be a stopgap solution, it's a symptom, it's not the heart of the matter.
The only thing that I would add to that is that, since I'm the international student who wound up on the panels, is that international students do not have the ability to stay longer. Our visas are only for 4 years. So oftentimes you can push them till 5, but a lot of students, that's not an option for many reasons, especially if funding runs out because we have such limited funding options. But one of the things that I've noticed amongst my friends who are international students from all over the world is that we tend to be incredibly publicly engaged, and it's something that we're very committed to because we see Canada as providing us with an education, so we want to be able to give back. And so often we are really actively publicly engaged, and we're often thinking in different ways because we come from different backgrounds and different institutions prior to our graduate degrees, but we really have to sort of stay on task on a level because our funding options are so limited, and because of the way that the immigration rules regulate international students currently. So, I mean, this is also goes beyond, whenever we talk about these issues with international students, it's obviously a much broader issue and goes up to federal government, but just to keep that in mind.
Hi, a question for Matthew, actually. I think you made a lot of excellent points, and I really like how actually I thought it tied into a lot of other points that were earlier made, particularly in regards to mental health, and I'll explain. I know that isolation and stress are kind of a part of pretty much every graduate program, but it's that 80 to 90% that are left to fend to themselves that you mentioned that I think are what make this a really unique problem to the humanities. And it's not just 80 to 90% that are just find themselves surprised at the end that they don't have work and what they're intending to in the academia. But from my conversations with students and my faculties, it's many of them who are still in the program that don't win these extremely competitive awards that kind of see the writing on the wall and know even before they finish their program, they kind of have this dead in the water feeling where they're not even started yet. And do you feel that if perhaps, like you say, there's systems in place or maybe the public works, public jobs had more encouragement to hire these academic students, that it would be something that would kind of maybe help with that problem?
Yeah, I think part of the problem is there's a lot of platitudes when you're feeling that way. When you approach colleagues, when you approach faculty members with any sort of concerns about what you're going to do afterwards, you often get, oh, don't worry, you'll get a job. I've heard so-and-so that they got a job. And platitudes don't help when you have this deep set anxiety, when you're already struggling to pay the bills, and you're already, feeling like a failure before you even started, that not having anybody else invested in your future, really feels, And you know, maybe it's entirely our own fault for doing a PhD in the humanities, but it really feels like somehow, even though we've been told many, many times, it still feels like we've been led along as a lamb to slaughter kind of thing. And it feels like there just isn't that kind of support. It feels that there isn't that kind of concern or awareness of the problem. And because it's jobs, you can't turn to your colleagues in your cohort because they're fighting for the same jobs. And so there really is this kind of isolation and intense isolation and fear and anxiety about what am I going to do? Did I just waste 4 years? How do I start over? All those kind of questions are constantly running through your head. And it does make it really hard to finish the dissertation that's already hard enough to finish on its own.
We're going to take one final comment. Yeah.
My name is Mike Webster. I'm the president of the Graduate Students Association of the University of Calgary. That's a question generally for the whole panel. Wondering if maybe you could summarize the discussion yesterday around the anxiety that students feel when they reveal to their supervisor that they may be interested in careers beyond academia, and what that might potentially pose in terms of interference with them completing their degrees or receiving additional funding.
Yes. Well, I can tell that I can tell you that I haven't actually had this conversation with my supervisor. He's a wonderful man, and I'm sure that it would go over fine. I wouldn't face any repercussions, but it's not something that I actively talk about with my supervisor. I mean, one of my committee members is in the room, so I'm sure we'll have this conversation later today. But and the thing is I'm not giving up on an academic career. I just am very aware that the odds of me getting an academic career in early modern literature is not particularly high. There's not a lot of them. I don't know if I've seen a job posting in Canada for early modern lit. So anyways, that's my thoughts.
Well, I guess I've always been pretty open about the fact that I'm not... my life doesn't hang by a thread in that sense that, you know, I'm not 100%, I guess, dependent on the idea of an academic job. I've always really been pretty happy with the idea of working in outside. But I think it's one of these things that working in an area that is... I guess it's a bit challenging to break into academia to begin with. So this is for me, it's a pet project. But I do actually view this as a job unto itself, right? This is 5 years of my life that I'm spending in a job where it is pretty secure for me. I know I'll have money for the next few years. I can live on that. So I'm happy as far as it's a job. To me, it's a job. And I'm not sure how many other people think this way or feel that way, but yeah.
I had to remind my supervisor, I hope that the people at MUN don't go running back and explain this conversation to him, but I did have to remind him because when I was looking at my comps list had to be slightly tweaked because I am not hoping to find a job in maritime history because there aren't any. And I do want to go back to the museum field, but what's actually been trickier is expressing... I know my field, I was a curator for 5 years, but expressing to my department and to my committee what I need from them and how we need to shape my program in a way that fits my career goals. And luckily they're wonderful and open people and they're willing to work with me on that. But I am also the first person with a museum degree to come through the program. So there's been a little adjusting that's had to take place. What's also been lucky for me is that I have really good support from my master's program, and they can help translate. Unfortunately, if I was wanting to do this and I hadn't had that background, I would have had a much harder time trying to express, and I don't think it would have been clear what resources I needed. I'm pretty loud, as you might have guessed, so I'm very good at that, and my supervisor is amazingly flexible. But for a new graduate student or someone who's coming into the field, we need, when we're speaking about transparency, we need to know that you're open to that. Because I had to plan my meeting with my supervisor, who I get on great with, to say, I just want to remind you, Sean, I am not trying to be an academic. I'm not opposed to it, but we need to make this program work for me. I had to plan that for 2 days. And so, like, we need to know that you guys are, that faculty and administrators are open to those ideas. Even if it's just a, hey, I hope you follow my footsteps, but just so you know, I'm open to what you want to do. Because that, those little things, and this ties back into mental health, make a huge difference. We need those little, don't sweat it. We'll figure this out, because that makes a huge difference. And I got that from him, but not with a little anxiety on my part.
I remember being in an academic conference once, and somebody said before I picked my dissertation topic, they said, make sure you choose your dissertation topic well, because the average dissertation lasts longer than the average Canadian marriage. Which might in fact be true, horrifyingly enough. And of course, the divorce is not exactly a fun experience for those who have gone through it, and I've talked to people about that as well. I have two wonderful supervisors. They we've had moments of misrecognition and moments of recognition. We felt a little bit like two Darwinian species at the zoo looking past each other in different cages, like, how did you get over there? What are you doing? We've had different moments that have been challenging, but I think they've both worked really well with me. I don't think what I want to do right now actually has a great place in the university system or outside of the university system. I think we need more scholars who can be in the university system and outside of the university system. As soon as you leave, there is no parachute to come back. There is no way to come back. And that is a huge problem, because there's a lot of benefit to having scholars who are good, who could be good in the university, being able to go and come back. And administrative people know this very well. People who've sat on as presidents or administrative of thinking or of societies, then they come back and they find it difficult to re-enter. So I'm being evasive of my own experience. But what I am saying is I think that what we need to do is be more mobile about people who want to stay in and out. And I'm going to say one more last thing, too, which is the problem sometimes right now, and it goes to Jacob's point about service, and it goes to other points that have been raised, too, about what counts as research. What we need to do is not create these alternative routes in the PhD program that makes the student self-identify right at the beginning, I'm off the tenure track. If you create scholarship, publicly engaged scholarship, that could both go into tenure and go out as an off-ramp. Otherwise, it's a bad faith gesture. It means that someone has to self-identify at the beginning, and then why are you doing a PhD to begin with? So you need to put the ability to do scholarship into the adjudication process so that it could go both ways and let somebody make a decision. And then it also builds skills that will allow somebody to go outside the university without... I mean, I've heard somebody say to me recently that a dissertation is a dead document when you leave, and that's a really harsh assessment, but is it true?
You can clap, that's fine. So, I realise that we're over time, so I'm just going to be very, very quick and thank the audience very much for their attention and for listening to us today and hopefully for hearing us. As I said, as Casey said at the beginning, what we really wanted to achieve was to highlight the problems that we have and the obstacles we face, but also some strategies for how we can make things better and the university can make things better and how we can work together to do that. So the two provocations that we've had and the discussion that we've had with the wonderful panellists, and thank you all so much, we need clearer lines of communication between departments, between the university and students. We need more culturally flexible and creative ways of teaching and creative curricula and creative modes of learning. And we need the university to be bolder in how it engages the humanities, how it values and promotes different types of writing and research. That's a terrible summary of some very complicated thoughts we've heard this morning, but I trust that you'll bear with me. We really hope that this conversation can start a greater one over the next 2 days. As Casey said, we all want to share our ideas and our thoughts with you, and we hope that you're open to that too. And lastly, I just want to say a huge thank you to the 30 students who have worked so hard with us over the last 2 days. It's been amazing, and I'm so grateful to know you. Thank you very much.
And thank you to Eliza and Casey for doing this for us. They were amazing.